Session number 19990, Reel 13.
Chief Technician Barry Roper, Reel 13. You were saying that the warrant officer probably wouldn't have an intimate knowledge of the aircraft, but he would know the men who were servicing them because of his background.
Oh yes. My warrant officer at the time... No, I'm sorry, not at that time. But you often got ex-pilots or people that had... They were wartime people that were more used to sort of Spitfires and Lancasters and things.
Were these former sergeant pilots, then, who'd gone up?
Yes. Because it wasn't until... In up to this time, you still had airmen and aircrew. But... then it changed, and they started that most pilots were pilot officers, flying officers, and so on. And it was only later that they reintroduced sergeant pilots, and some of them came back onto the helicopter side in Borneo. They then started drifting back. The introduction of the Hercules around this time, they trained. A lot of my friends at Northolt went to become flight engineers. Now, they'd already dispensed with flight engineers. Most of the old flight engineers had gone into MT sections or out of the service from the war. But then all of a sudden, with the Hercules, they needed a flight engineer, and so reintroduced flight engineers. They also were introducing air stewards or air... you got the, what do you call them, air load masters, and then you started to get air electronics operators as air crew, because we always, a lot of us thought about going air crew, and it was always being offered. And with the Shackleton and later the Nimrod introducing the air electronics operator, you then started to get airmen air crew again. Whereas they'd gone out of fashion in the late 50s.
Did the warrant officer live in the same mess as the sergeants?
Yes.
Now, I think were you a senior technician when you were...
Senior technician, yeah. Which the equivalent rank is sergeant, but we just had them upside down. And I think we might have had a little extra trade pay above a sergeant, but...
Do you know why it is that you weren't simply called a sergeant or a technical sergeant? Because it's it's more like to be called a chief or senior technician is more like a title than a rank, isn't it?
Well, the thing was that it was strictly to do with your trade qualifications, so that I knew when I would be promoted, providing I kept my nose clean, because having been a... corporal technician, 3 years after that I could become a senior technician, 4 years or 5 years out, by my 12th year I could be a chief technician. So all you did was take the exams, and on the day that you reached your 12th year you put the new rank up, unless of course you had anything against you, sort of if you made any serious mistakes they could take it away. But you knew when you were going to be promoted. And this, of course, the Air Force was top-heavy. There was a lot of old flight sergeants that had stayed in after the war, and they're all either doing minor jobs, and if you waited to get their position, you were waiting for dead men's shoes. And they needed technicians, and they needed them well-trained, and so they brought in this promotion on the technical ladder. And the highest promotion you could get was master technician, which was the equivalent to warrant officer. Sadly, that was thrown out before I got there, but it's the rank that I was aspiring to.
If you said that you could, your promotion could be stopped or delayed if you made a mistake, could it be stopped or delayed if you got into disciplinary trouble? Was that also a possible block to advancement?
For misdemeanours, I would have thought you might have had it delayed by a period of time. You have to wait another year or something, but It happens so infrequently that...
What did happen to someone who got into trouble? Because you were saying that it was a very, very extraordinary thing if someone lost rank, went down, and in the army, being busted down from Lance Corporal to private is quite a normal thing, mm-hmm. or infraction to discipline. If you got into trouble in the Air Force, what sanctions were applied normally?
Well, I came across... one man was... they were caught smuggling. We used to do overseas trips, and in those days you went and you bought all the cigarettes and the watches and things, and you stowed them somewhere in the aircraft that nobody sort of knew about. And sadly, this aircraft had an accident, and they tore it apart, and there was kimonos and cigarettes and you name it. And the whole crew, from the pilot down, moved down one rank.
Yes. So that's a serious punishment, a demotion. But what about somewhat lesser things?
Well, there are certain crimes in the Air Force.
Yes.
Stealing fuel, aircraft fuel, that because you're awash with thousands and thousands of gallons of petrol, and there are temptations to put this petrol in your car, and so on. Now, because it's so easy to do, anybody caught doing it is really made an example of. Negligence, if you sent an aircraft off and you'd forgot to put an oil cap on or something like this, and the pilot gets airborne and all of a sudden all the oil pours overboard and he has to abort and come down again, you would be, I don't say court-martialed, but it would be a serious technical offence. And it might delay your promotion, or even in certain cases, you would lose your rank.
And what would happen if it was not so, you know, something not so important as that? Would you? Was there a system of fining or?
Oh yes, normally they would fine. If you insulted the CO or you swore at the warrant officer or something like that, you would be fined.
Who dealt with that? Did that go up before? Was there a sort of formal procedure, well, like orders in the army?
Normally it could be dealt with by the flight commander.
Yes.
If it was slightly more serious and they thought you needed a bigger punishment, it would go to the squadron commander. Mm. And if it warranted it, you would then go to the wing commander. But usually if it got to that stage, it was going to be something serious and you could elect to be tried by court-martial. Mm. Most senior NCOs would, I think, automatically go to the wing commander for the judgment.
What sort of thing would he hand out?
In the case of NCOs, it was either loss of seniority or fines. I had a friend who made a very serious technical error and it killed the crew and lost an aircraft, and he was reduced to the ranks, and I think he went to prison for so long. And normally you find that when these people have served the punishment, they come out of wherever they've been, they are very quickly reinstated in 6 monthly stages, and they often gain higher rank. In fact, this particular man ended up higher than me, and yet he'd been knocked back and had to work his way up a second time.
Having learned a very serious lesson.
That's right. There was also another case where it was a very famous crash at Abingdon, where a Beverly had the non-return valves fitted the wrong way round in the fuel system, and on takeoff with a load of dog handlers and all sorts, all engines cut on takeoff, and the aircraft was lost.
Or it just pancaked?
Well, it stalled in from the end of the runway, and it was a very, very serious accident. Mm-hmm. And the gentleman was stripped and sent to prison, and he ended up being commissioned when he came out of prison, you know. So things work. Some people say you need a good court martial to really get on in this man's Air Force, and it worked in a lot of cases during my time anyway.
What happened to ordinary airmen if they were in trouble for being drunk or disorderly or
something? We used to. Usually they got defaulters or extra duties. And later on, money to fine them seemed to be sort of the right thing because it hurt them. But the problem was that if you were going to fine them money, you were then going to have to give them the option of a court martial, and in some cases, for a petty crime, the flight commander would fine them a week's pay or something, and the lad would then say, "Well, I'll elect to be tried by court martial." And the snag was that they didn't let him be tried by a court martial because it was going to cost thousands, and it was such a ridiculously
small thing.
But with drunken charges, it was usually a fine anyway, and I don't think you got the option of a court-martial because they'd have thrown you out or what have you. But discipline, you don't get the same amount of charging and things in the Air Force as probably in the Army.
Now, you mentioned that you were in Cyprus, you were studying for the examinations, and that passing the examinations was one of the things you had to do in order to get the promotion.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things were you studying?
Well, apart from your basic trade, to be a corporal tech, you had to have one specialisation. Now, you could choose one of the spec quals I could have taken was the 3,000-gallon refuelling bowser. And you had to know everything about this bowser, flushing it, how much it weighed, and all the operation, all the valves and bypasses and things of this thing. Well, because I had worked on helicopters and I had done a lot of the transmission system, nowadays the transmission and the gearboxes belong to the blades belong to the airframe trade. But in the early days, they belonged to the engine trade, the transmission and the gearboxes. And so one of my easy things to qualify on was helicopter blades and transmission systems, because I only had to learn about the blades and so on. I knew the transmission system backwards, so that became one spec qual. Then, when I'd been at Northolt, my other spec qual was Devon pneumatic systems. Now, these are outside my trade, but I was allowed to take them, and so I ended up, for my sins, with a specialist qualification of helicopter blades and transmission systems and Devon pneumatics, because the other options to me in my own trade were very difficult. So I took the easy way out. But
how did you do this studying? Was it...
Well, there's a sort... You're given... a sort of brief as to what the questions are likely to be, and it's usually on current things like the Avon 200 series, and you might have to describe the fuel system on an Avon 200 or what have you, and it's normally an oral board, and then you sit a written paper for in my case, the blades and transmission systems. And because the person who is examining you can't know everything, he knows the general questions on hydraulic pumps and oleo legs and all the rest of it. But where it's a specific aircraft and a very complicated system, then he goes to a unit to the specialist in that unit and said, "Make me up a question paper," and they probably give him 150 questions, of which he selects 25, and he gives it to you. And periodically they change it, because if you're on a small unit where that's the only unit that has the aircraft, one bloke goes up and he gets 25 questions. He comes back and he tells you what he was asked. You gen up on those answers and go back. And you find they've changed them for 25 other ones, and so there's no fiddling that way.
But the actual studying itself, how did you do that? Did you have formal classroom instructor.
No. We got the air publications that we needed. There's general fitters handbooks and things like that, which everybody has. But then you get the specific, it might be the Bowser air publication. And I was single, living in a tent, but the sergeant was in a nice quarter. And we used to go over to his house and sit there with a few beers, asking each other questions and sort of studying the books, and then a sort of question and answer series between each of us. And it was very pleasant evenings, and his wife used to bring us supper at the end of it, and you'd go home if you could walk. But no, that it was... you had to help each other because, well, we'd all had a different background, and where I knew, well, the helicopter, he knew whatever he'd been working on, and it was an exchange of sort of information.
Where did you get the air publications from?
There's always a library at tech pubs on every station. And it carries all the air publications of the equipment used on that station for every section, the MT section, all the aircrew manuals and so on. And these are constantly being updated. And all the time, sections are receiving amendments. And you sort of open the book, tear half the pages out, put another dozen pages in.
But were they loose leaf then?
Yes, they're all loose leaf. And... at the front there's a sheet, and I mean this on the Sycamores we had APs that the army had used on the Mark 11, and the last amendments were done in 1951 or something, and we're now trying to operate the aircraft in 1960, and this was where we had this accident where this ballast platform had been removed. And we didn't even know it should have been there, as subsequently came out at the unit inquiry when it rolled over.
So that was because the publication had not been updated, the characteristics of the aircraft had been changed without you knowing it. And it was
the air publication was incomplete. When they had the unit inquiry, there'd been no ballast platform in the aircraft, and also the bit that explained, I went in about this envelope and this the size of a postcard where you had to keep your centre of gravity in that range. Well, the bit that explained that wasn't in the AP, and the snag was that normally you can spot if a page is missing because you read down and it's chapter 3, and then if you look and the next one's chapter 5, where's chapter 4? But unfortunately, this particular AP, the page that was missing, it read something like chapter 3, and there was a chapter 3A, and then there was a chapter 4. And this page was missing from this old AP. It was, we were lucky. Pilot's notes and things like that hadn't been amended. And it was just a nasty accident. If the pilot had been flying a Mark 14, there wouldn't have been any problem. And he described it as an oleo leg collapsing. Well, of course, the first thing we did when we righted the aircraft was take the oleos off. And they were checked, and they were spot on. So they said, think again. And it was ground resonance, but it was so rapid that the pilot... I mean, normally it bounces from wheel to wheel, and you've got a split second to lift off again. Yeah. But this thing just went straight over, and with disastrous consequences.
One thing that occurs to me about that is that the question of the nature of the ground. When you were flying operational in Cyprus, you showed me a photograph of an aircraft, a helicopter landing on a rather narrow ridge. Did you always land on prepared helicopter landing pads?
No, but the ground had to be reasonably flat.
Yes.
Otherwise, I mean, in certain circumstances, you just put one wheel down and rest the aircraft on the ground with the rotors running. I mean, in a lot of cases. But if you are going to have to be constantly starting and stopping the rotor, then the ground had to be fairly good. Because, I mean, a flat field would be all right, and you've got ruts and things. But when you first start a helicopter, to get that mass of rotor going round, the thing rocks from side to side until there's enough momentum to sort of lift a little bit. Yeah. And
wouldn't men getting out of a helicopter on one wheel change the trim as they were leaving it?
Well, no. The pilot is sort of expecting this anyway, and he's either counteracting it by holding the... When you shut a helicopter down, the blades are tilted forwards and to one side. So when the stick is upright, your blades are down at the front and over to the left in the thing. Well, the pilot, when he shuts down, pulls the stick over so that he levels the disc, and then there are some things on the sycamore called droop stops, and they're like three large lollipops that stick up above the head, and they've got a weight on the top, and as the blades speed up or slow down, these weights just come in, and it leaves a step behind so that the blade can't droop too far, you see. And to get these droop stops in, when you're flying, they're outwards, and the steps are away from the blade so the blade can flap up and down. But as you stop you are going to shut the engine down and you're going to stop the blades, you pull the stick over to level the head, and as the rotor speed decays, these droop stops go in. They usually go in one at a time, and the marshaler that is normally there, you can feel them when you're in the aircraft, one, two, and you might have one sticking out, and the marshaler will indicate that you've got a droop stop stuck out, and he'll get you to rev up again, get the three of them out. And if there's one sticks out and you can't get it back in, then we used to wash them back in with a fire hose.
Push the lollipop back.
They're sort of out at an angle of 45 degrees, yes. And you can just see them on that photograph there. Yes, there's three little things sticking. Yes. That's a better one. You can see.
Yeah, you can see.
And now on the Mark 10, we didn't have these centrifugal droop stops. We had a droop stop ring, which was a rubber ring that the blades collapsed onto. And so the blades on this thing were lower to the ground anyway. That's the technicalities of the sycamore, I'm afraid.
And, I mean, you say level. How level did it have to be? Did you have to have it sort of spirit level?
No. It was just a case that... I mean, it's got such a pronounced tilt forward. This is so that when you're flying forward... You don't have to hold the stick forward to fly forward. It's naturally rigged to have a forward motion to it. And also, to counteract the torque, you've got the tilt to one side, and also you've got your tail rotor, which is counteracting the torque. So really, if you were to fly hands-off, theoretically, the helicopter should be flying at a normal cruising speed forwards. It's only when you come into the hover that you've got to pull the stick back and put the power on and level the rotor, because you're less in the hover than you are in forward flight.
Yeah. And it sounds to me as though, from what you're saying, when you are conducting these landing and shutting down operations, it really is flying by feel, as far as the pilot is concerned.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, he knows, if he's going to close down, he knows that those droop stops have got to go in. And they go in with quite a clunk, and you can usually feel it clunk, clunk, clunk. But occasionally there's one, they're stepped, and so there might be two vertical and one just at an angle. And the winchman will, or the marshaler will indicate that he's got one and it's not fully in. And the pilot may just move the stick over slightly and it'll lift it, and the thing will go
into
vertical
place.
Into place, you see. But you've got to make sure, and once they're in place, the marshaler will tell you, cut your engine, you're safe.
Now, you were saying earlier on that at Northolt it was almost like a civilian establishment.
Well, a lot of the staff there were there for a reason. They had children in Great Ormond Street Hospital. The wife had a special hospital to go to and so on. It was a lot of compassionate postings. Mm. Not possibly so many on the technical side, but certainly the administrative staff and so on. A lot of them had good reasons to be there and they could never be posted.
Did you enjoy it there? Was it a good time?
It was a good time. I met my wife and we were married while I was there. I moved into a flat in Kingston-on-Thames.
So you could live out?
Yes, I lived. When I was married, I lived out. But sadly, all things, all good things come to an end. I'd gone there in October 1959, but in July of 1963... it was civilianised. They moved in a civilian company to take over the servicing of the helicopters and the fixed-wing aircraft, and so the permanent staff were posted. And
did you have much warning that that was going to happen?
Oh yes, we knew it was on the cards, and most of us knew where we were going to be posted to, but I think I'd have still been there yet if... because it was the sort of job that they find your heart to replace, and they keep you there, you know, if they possibly can.
How was the handover to the civilian company done? Were you involved in?
I was involved with it.
Replacement?
The problem we had was that there were a lot of young airmen that had gone out of the service that came back in to work for the company that were taking over, and to be honest, they hadn't got the same expertise as the people that were leaving. And I was talking to one of the flight commanders later, and they said, "Oh, this new firm's good." They said they can do a primary 2-star on a Pembroke in 3.5 hours, whereas it would take us at least 8 or probably even 12. And I said, it's impossible. So he said, no, put the aircraft in first thing in the morning, you've got it by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I said, well, they're not doing the servicing, I'm sorry, but it's just impossible. And there were things that we had to do. We had to drain the aircraft of its fuel, we had to jack it up into a flying position, and we had to disconnect all the linkage on the undercarriage to do crack detection. Every 50 hours, I think this happened, or every so many landings. And it was a long job, and once you'd done it and you put it all back together, there was independent checks. We had to have retraction tests with special rigs to check that the undercarriage, after we'd had it apart, would operate and function correctly. And this work, it was impossible for them to have done it in the time that they were doing it in. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, if that's the way they do it, I said, I can do a primary 2-star in 2 minutes. I said, here, give me the book and I'll sign for it. And I said, there you are, you've got your... And they realised, I think, that corners were being cut. Now, it's funny that under these sort of circumstances, where they were making us do it to the book, then they start altering the books to make it easier for the civilian firm to cope, because they haven't got the same amount of manpower, they haven't got the same amount of experience. And I was glad to be out of the way before anything serious happened, you know.
I think your next posting was down to Odium.
Yes, well, during the period that I was in Cyprus and Northolt, Cyprus and Malaya had proved to the army, at least, that the use of helicopters and the things like twin pioneers, single pioneers, beavers and so on, they were useful tools. And so Odium at this time was developing into a centre for helicopter flying. Previously, all pilots used to go through Little Risington, I think even the army pilots probably down at... was it Middle Wallop and so on, but it was all centred in that area. Bristol Aeroplane Company and Westlands were in the south, and most of our pilots had trained at Little Risington. But now Odeon was being